Warning, contents of this episode may include murder, sexual assault, including rape, molestation, and various types of other sexual assault, physical assault, abuse, and possible gore. It is advised that you listen at your own risk. Also, mentions of wishes of suicide. Disclaimer, just because someone may have a mental disorder doesn't mean they'll 100% turn out to be a serial killer. This goes for other factors as well. I'd recommend doing your research before assuming something like that. Alrighty guys, welcome back to another episode of Thinking Out Loud. And this is part two of the serial killers John Wayne Gacy, the killer clown. This is part two of that. So to recap the first episode, I believe we left off where Gacy arrived at the police station at 3:02 a.m. covered in mud, said he had a car accident, and that was confirmable because he had his car towed around 2 a.m. a couple miles away from where Peast's body was dumped. So now we're just gonna get into the first search warrant and the stuff that happened after that.
Okay.
the first search warrant. So, they suspected Gacy was holding Peast against his will in his house, so a search warrant was obtained on December 13th. The search revealed these suspicious items. A 6mm Brevetada starting pistol in an office drawer, a syringe and hypodermic needle in Gacy's bathroom, handcuffs, books on homosexuality and pederasty, which is a relationship between an adult male and a pubescent and or adolescent boy, so basically pedophilia. 7 porno films, capsules of a substance called amyl nitrite, 18-inch dildo in his bedroom, 39-inch 2x4 with holes drilled into each end. This, of course, we mentioned earlier, was used to restrain their feet. Bottles of Valium and atropine, those being a type of medicine used to treat types of nerve agent, pesticide poisonings, or types of slow heart rates, and it is also used to decrease saliva production during surgeries as well. They also found several driver's licenses in the northwest bedroom, a blue hooded parka on top of the toolbox in the laundry room, underwear that clearly wasn't Gacy's in a bathroom closet, a class 1975 Maine West High School school ring, or class ring, with the initials JAS engraved on it. This was later linked to John Sizek, who had been missing for 2 years at this point. There was also a Nissan pharmacy photo receipt in a trash can, and of course Nissan Pharmacy is where Peast worked, so yeah, why? They also found a 36-inch section of nylon rope. Police confiscated Gacy's Oldsmobile as well as other PDM work vehicles. They assigned two-man surveillance teams to watch Gacy on a daily 12-hour basis as they continued investigating his background and possible involvement in Peast going missing. The teams were made up of Mike Albrecht and David Hatchmeister, as well as Ronald Robinson and Robert Schultz. The next day, police received a call from Michael Rossi informing of the disappearance of Gregory Godzik and that the body of former PDM employee Charles Hetula had been found drowned in the river in Illinois earlier that year. Now, it is never confirmed whether Charles Hetula was one of Gacy's victims. I believe I might have left that part out. I don't know. But he had been found in the river, in a river in Illinois earlier that year, which kind of brings to question why is he reporting it now? Because to me that seems like it was months earlier, but maybe not so. It was on December 15th that more details were obtained on Gacy's battery charge. They learned that Jeffrey Rignall had gone through, and that Rignall was dumped at Lincoln Park with very severe facial and chest burns, along with rectal bleeding. They learned of the disappearance of Butkovic through an interview with one of Gacy's ex-wives. I think she suspected something, if you ask me. This was also the day they linked the class ring they found when searching Gacy's home to John Alec Sizek. It was Sizek's mother who mentioned several things missing from her son's apartment. This included a Motorola TV set. On December 16th, Gacy had regularly invited the members of the surveillance team, watching him for meals at restaurants or drinks at the bar. Again, he denied any involvement with Peast's disappearance and claimed the police were harassing him because of his political connections or recreational drug use. He often violated traffic laws and lost his pursuers more than once, all because he knew they weren't able to arrest him for trivial things. That afternoon, Cram was interviewed by police, describing Gacy as hardworking and having an open-minded attitude on homosexuality. Cram also explained that Gacy had also given him a watch, saying that he had gotten it from a dead person. Rossi was interviewed the next day, saying that Sizek's vehicle was sold to him by Gacy. Gacy's vehicle was also being tested on this day. Investigators found a clump of fibers in the trunk of his car, which was thought to have been human hair. They tested Gacy's confiscated vehicles with three trained German shepherds to see if Peast had been in any of the vehicles at any point. So they tested not only Gacy's personal car, but the work vehicles that they took as well. Upon approaching the Oldsmobile, one of the dogs had what its handler described as a death reaction. I could not tell you what that means, but it probably means, like, they sensed the smell of a dead body or something. This indicated that Peast had in fact been... This indicated that Peast had in fact been inside of Gacy's car. Meanwhile, Gacy had invited Albrecht and Hackmeister to a restaurant for a meal with him. Early the morning of December 18th, he invited them to another restaurant for breakfast. They talked business, his marriages, and activities as the clowns he portrayed, which led to his famous statement, "You know, clowns can get away with murder." It was also by December 18th that Gacy had begun to show signs of strain from constantly being watched by the police. He looked visibly tired and was unshaven, anxious, and drank heavily. It was at some point on the 18th or 19th that Gacy had invited two police officers to his house for breakfast, depending on what article you are reading. But later on, Gacy and his lawyers prepared a $750,000 suit against the Des Plaines Police Department. His demands were that they stop having him surveilled. While this was going down, a serial number found on the receipt from the Nissan pharmacy that was found in the pocket of the parka was traced to 17-year-old Kimberly Byers. When questioned the following day, Byers explained that she had used the jacket on December 11th to stay warm, and that she had placed the receipt in the pocket before giving it to Peast when he was leaving. So that being said, how did Gacy have it? if he had no contact with Peast whatsoever, how did that end up in his house? She said that a contractor was wanting to offer Peast a job, so this makes Gacy's alibi a bit untrue. It makes it almost completely untrue, because he said, I did not offer him a job, I did not bring him home, I did not have any contact with him. How did the jacket end up in your house, sir? How did the jacket that had a receipt in the pocket that was traced back to another person that gave the jacket to Peast, how did that end up in your house? Because that would be a question I would have. Rossi was then interviewed a second time. Being more cooperative this time around, he told the officers what happened the summer of 1977. He said that Gacy had him spread 10 bags of quicklime in the crawl space on either the 19th or 20th of December. Police found out about the sodomy charge of a teenage boy while Gacy was in Waterloo. Again, they found this out in 1978. Towards the end of 1978. So. And this was. And the sodomy charge was in Waterloo, Iowa. They had also begun compiling evidence for a second search warrant to be obtained. Gacy's civil suit was being filed while this was happening. The hearing had been scheduled for December 22nd. The surveillance team was invited inside by Gacy that afternoon. Officer Robinson distracted Gacy as Officer Schultz went to Gacy's bedroom to trying to write down the serial numbers of the Motorola TV that he had in there. This was unsuccessfully attempted. They suspected that it might be the TV that was missing from Sizek's apartment. It was while flushing the toilet that the officer smelled the odor of a rotting corpse coming from the heating duct. In the first search, this had gone unnoticed. The house was cold at the time. I suspect that Gacy did that on purpose, because he probably knew that they would smell it, because he smelled it. So they were like, so he was like, they're gonna come search my house, I better turn off the heat so they can't smell all the rotting bodies I've got in the crawl space. Interviewers brought Cram and Rossi in again for more questioning. Rossi agreed to this because he had links to both Sizek and Peast. When asked where Gacy might have had hidden Peast's body by Kozensack, Rossi replied by saying he thinks it might be in the crawl space. Good observation, but no. He also thought that Sizek's car was stolen as well. Rossi agreed to participate in a polygraph test, denied involvement in Peast's disappearance, and denied any knowledge of his whereabouts. Rossi then refused any further questions, and due to his inconsistent responses during the polygraph test, Kozensack was unable to identify a definite opinion. Rossi did, however, further explain the trench digging that he did in the crawl space, saying that Gacy insisted that he did not stray from where he was told to dig. Cram informed investigators about Gacy's attempts to rape him in 1776. Cram said that Gacy went pale after he saw a clump of mud that he assumed had been from the crawl space after his house was searched on December 13th. He had grabbed a flashlight and went to see if anyone had dug in the crawl space. Cram was asked if he'd been in the crawl space at any point, to which he replied that Gacy had once asked him to spread lime down there and dug trenches as well. He was told by Gacy that they were for drainage pipes. Cram stated that the trenches were 2 feet in width, 6 feet in length, and 2 feet in depth, the size of graves. So it was not in, it was in fact not for drainage pipes. They were digging graves for bodies. On the evening of December 20th or 21st, Gacy had been caught distributing packages that contained marijuana to a gas station clerk. He was then followed and arrested. Police had learned that Gacy already confessed to murder to his own lawyer, Sam Amarante. He had gone to the office that day to discuss the suit. Gacy appeared disheveled and asked for some whiskey, which Sam Amarante then brought. Gacy noticed in an article of the Daily Herald on Amarante's desk. The article in front of him was covering the missing persons case of Robert Peast. Then he said, "This boy is dead. He's dead. He's in a river." This was followed by a long confession that went into the early morning hours of the following day. He described himself as judge, jury, and executioner of many people. He then explained his wish to be the same thing for himself. He told where he had buried the majority of his bodies and that 5 were now in the Des Plaines River. He said his victims were male prostitutes, hustlers, and liars, and that he would sometimes wake to see the dead bodies on the floor with their hands cuffed behind their backs. The reason he gave for burying them where he did is that he believed that they were his property, that being he thought the bodies of the dead men, the dead young men that he killed, he thought that they belonged to him. Gacy fell asleep in the middle of his confession due to the amount of alcohol he was drinking. Nothing like passing out in the middle of confessing to murdering 33 young men and boys, right? Hate it when that happens. Alcohol can make people do some strange things, such as confess to murdering 33 young men and boys. After this, Amarante rightfully arranged a psychiatric appointment for 9 a.m. that day. He was thinking, okay, this guy's either really drunk or he's cray-cray. So I'm just gonna book him an appointment to get him checked out. When Gacy awoke, Amarante told him that he had just confessed to murdering 30 people. Gacy just simply shook his head. He explained that he couldn't think about that because he had too many other things to do. He didn't go to the appointment as advised and instead went to tend to the needs of his business. He later recollected the memories of what he had been said and done on his final day of freedom as hazy. perhaps because of the alcohol. He knew that he was going to be arrested, and he was going to... And so he went to visit his friends to say goodbye. He even told one of his friends, Ronald Rode, in tears, that he had killed 30 people. He also told the gas station attendant, "The end is coming for me," as he handed him the package that was later turned over to police because it had marijuana in it. He then drove to Cram's house to talk to Cram and Rossi. Surveillance noted that Gacy had been holding a rosary to his chin and praying when going to Cram's home. After meeting with Cram, Cram drove Gacy to meet the lawyer, Leroy Stevens. While this was being done, Cram informed police that Gacy had confessed to both him and Rossi that he had murdered over 30 people. Might I mention, this is all while people are living with Gacy. So I'm thinking his claim of accomplices might be a bit true. So again, Cram informed police, like, hey, this guy that I'm living with currently confessed to murdering over 30 people. So yeah. Gacy was then driven by Cram to Mary Hill Cemetery to visit Gacy's father's grave. Gacy had gone to several places that day. As he was doing so, police had finally outlined the formal draft of the second search warrant to search for Robert Peast's body. Police accused Gacy of kidnapping and holding Peast there against his will, threatened to tear up his floors to find the boy's body. He again denied that Peast had been to his house, but did show where he buried someone that he said he was forced to kill because of self-defense. He led investigators to his garage and marked where he buried the body with a can of spray paint. I do not believe he murdered John Butkovic in self-defense, and I don't think he buried Timothy McCoy under the garage. So that's where John Butkovic's body was. So Gacy was lying through his teeth, which is not surprising. But yeah, he said he was forced to kill them because of self-defense and led them to where he buried the body, marked it with spray paint. I believe Wikipedia or one of the articles I read said it was orange, but I cannot confirm that. This is where they found parts of at least 3 bodies, so they were like, okay, this guy's definitely murdered more than what he said he's murdered. And we also have these statements from other people saying that he confessed to 30 murders, so. Before this, they saw that Gacy had unplugged the sump pump to drain the crawl space. They simply replaced the plug and waited for the water to drain. After that, they began digging and found flesh in the 5th stage of death. Like, after rigor mortis and all that stuff. 5th stage of decomposition, basically. They also found arm bones. One unnamed police photographer and evidence technician, Daniel Genty, shouted, "I think this place is full of kids," when digging in the southwest area of the crawl space, indicating that Gacy could now be charged with murder. Sorry. I hit my arm on the desk. The two then went digging in the northeast corner of the crawl space, finding a kneecap. They also found two lower leg bones when digging in the southeast area of the crawl space. They noticed that these bodies were too decomposed to be pieced. Right next to the body being unearthed, that in the northeast corner, they found a skull, feet, another skull beneath those feet, and when technicians returned, they discovered the rib cage of a fourth victim. So it is at this point that the bodies are piling up. I have to think, oh boy, what a day it was for the people that did this. Like, you're just, they went searching for one missing kid and were suspecting Gacy of having been involved in that. Then one kid, one boy, turned into 33. And some are still unidentified to this day. On December 22nd, Gacy was informed of these findings and that he could be charged with murder, so he basically thought, well, no sense in keeping it a secret now, which, when researching this, I just put that in myself. I don't know if he actually said that or anything or thought that. I wouldn't want to know what was going on in his head at the time, so, yeah. In another several hours long confession, Gacy confessed to the murder of 32 to 33 young men after raping them. He referred to himself in third person during these confessions, using the names Jack or John. Basically claiming he had some type of other personality. He said he had buried 27 that would later be discovered to actually be 29 of the bodies on his own property. Said the other five, the fifth one was never found, one of which was never found, were in the Des Plaines River. One of the five he said he dumped was Peast's body. So the body they were looking for at his house wasn't even there. He gave the names of six of his victims and was charged with murdering Peast, even though they hadn't found his body at this point. He had planned to cover the crawl space completely in January 1979 with concrete. Of course, he was caught before then, so didn't get to. Gacy gave investigators a rough diagram of his basement on a phone message sheet to help them find where he had buried the bodies. Within the next week, they unearthed 26 bodies from the crawl space, as well as 3 from other places on his property. Cook County Medical Examiner Robert Stein oversaw the exhumation. Each section of the crawl space was numbered, as were the bodies at the time. For the first body, which was found in the section of crawl space under Gacy's office, a cause of death couldn't be determined. The second was John Bukovic. December 23rd, they unearthed 3 bodies that were buried in the same trench as body 1. Body 3 was above body 4, body 5 next to those, and body 5 was underneath where body 1 was found. Exhumation was postponed for a while for unspecified reasons. On December 26th, when they resumed, bodies 6 through 9 were found. The next day, they found bodies 10 through 17. December 28th, bodies 18 through 21. The day after that was bodies 22 through 27. The Chicago blizzard of 1979 then interfered with operations. They resumed in March, even though Gacy had said they found all the bodies, which we probably know now is far from the truth. March 9th, they found body 28. March 16th was body, they found body 29. 23 victims were identified by dental records, 2 more by skeletal trauma. And several others we'll later find out were later identified. The most recent one being in 2017 were done through DNA. These traumas were supported by objects found in Gacy's house. Several of the bodies found still had rope around their necks when they were unearthed, as well as foreign objects like pill bottles lodged in the pelvic region. Stein had concluded that 12 of the victims did not die from strangulation, but from asphyxiation. A victim found 6 miles downstream of I-55 wasn't linked to Gacy at first. It was identified as Timothy O'Rourke by fingerprints and a tattoo reading Tim Lee, which is an homage to Bruce Lee, of course, on his left biceps. He was victim 31, or body 31. It was later discovered that he was one of Gacy's victims later on. Body 32 was that of Frank Landingen, suffocated due to his own underwear being lodged in his throat. On December 28th, the body of James Mazzara was found 1 mile from I-55. It is not said what number he was. And then the final body was found on April 9th, 1979. The body was that of Robert Piest, identified by dental records, found entangled in exposed roots on the edge of the Des Plaines River. It was found that 3 wads of paper-like material had been shoved down his throat while he was still alive, and that caused him to suffocate. Only 27 victims were identified. The interest in doing so was renewed in October 2011 by Cook County Sheriff Thomas Dart. This led to the identification of Body 19, William Bundy, which was in November of 2011, and Body 24, James Hackinson, the most recent one identified yet, in 2017. Bodies 28, 26, 13, 21, 5, and 10 have not yet been identified. And their descriptions are on Wikipedia, which I will link in the description of this episode. As for possible accomplices, FBI profiler Robert Ressler was informed by Gacy that a few PDM employees, along with Cram and Rossi, had assisted in some of these crimes. This was never confirmed or denied. Rignall had mentioned that while he was being tortured, he could see a young brown-haired man kneeling in front of him and watched what was being done to Rignall. As well as a light, he also saw a light turn on in another part of the house, possibly while Gacy was torturing him, so. 3 days before Gacy was arrested, surveillance followed him to a bar where he was meeting Michael Rossi and Ed Hefner. He was observed talking with the two out of earshot. Gacy had said in a hushed conversation that was overheard, I assume as they were walking closer to the police car, "You better not let me down. You effers, you owe it to me." Then Rossi asked, "And what? Buried like the other five?" Gacy said during one interview that three PDM employees were suspects in the case. He also said all three had keys to his house. Gacy named, other than Cram and Rossi, Philip Pask, an associate of a man named John Norman, who was a friend of Cram's. Norman had operated a sex trafficking ring in Chicago that was called the Delta Project. Victims Kenneth Parker and Michael Marino, who we know are the friends that were killed in the same day, had been seen alive last close to Norman's address. This led to a theory that Gacy was involved in the Delta Project. Other suspects were Robert Young, a traveling companion that Russell Nelson had visited at the time of his disappearance. Young told Nelson's parents different accounts of him going missing, telling them that he failed to arrive at the bar at the time he was supposed to, or he told investigators that they were standing in a crowd and looked away for a few seconds, looked back, and Nelson was just gone. Young did file a missing persons report, but afterward, he unsuccessfully tried to request money from Nelson's parents so they could finance a search for their now missing son. When Nelson's brothers arrived in Chicago to search for him, Young apparently offered them a job with PDM. Interesting. Young never testified at Gacy's trial, though. Travel records also indicated that Gacy was out of town for a PDM project the day after John Mowry went missing. We've talked about this before. Mowry's roommate was also a PDM employee. Now, we don't get the name of this roommate, so, yeah. Witnesses stated that the roommate had suggested that Mowry meet with someone who was going out of town just 2 days before Mowry had disappeared. Gacy's trial began on February 6th, 1980. Gacy confessed. So the argument was to whether to declare him insane or not. He was remitted to a state mental facility. Gacy told police that the crimes were committed by his alternate personality. He was never diagnosed with anything like dissociative identity disorder or any other personality disorder besides antisocial thing. after some deliberation, Gacy was found guilty of 33 murders. He became known as one of the U.S.'s most ruthless serial killers to date. He was sentenced to 12 death sentences and 21 natural life sentences. So he was going to die. He was not getting out this time. Remember when he said that he never wanted to go back to jail before? Well, now you're staying there, sir. Gacy was imprisoned at Menard Correctional Center in Illinois for around a decade and a half, tried appealing his sentence, as well as offering contradicting statements in interviews. Even though he had confessed, he declared his innocence in a 12-minute recorded 900 telephone number statement. As both sides on the death penalty expressed their opinions, Gacy died by lethal injection at the Stateville Correctional Center, Crest Hill, Illinois, on May 10th, 1994. While he was imprisoned at Menard, he studied the visual arts. This included painting. What he painted was shown to the public in an exhibition in Chicago at a gallery. In many of his paintings, he depicts himself as Pogo the Clown. Moloch's auction in 2017 auctioned off many of these paintings, along with pictures from the crime scene and from Gacy's trial. Three of the paintings were two originals of Pogo the Clown, and they call him Mr. Gacy. Three each selling for $4,685.20 and $380.67, respectively. That is $380.67. Eight others went unsold. Gacy was also Gacy was also partly what led to the Amber Alert that we mentioned before. Sam Amarante authored some procedures that were incorporated by the Illinois General Assembly, putting it into the Missing Child Recovery Act of 1984, which removes the 72-hour waiting period that you have to wait to file a missing persons report. This was later adopted by other states and formed a national network aimed at locating missing children. As for the location where the murders were committed, I don't think that you can go visit 8213 West Summerdale Avenue, Des Plaines, Illinois, because it has since been demolished and a different house has been put on top of it. The films that this case inspired were To Catch a Killer, released in 1992, based largely off of this investigation, Gacy in 2003 depicting his life from 1971 to his arrest in 1978. And Dear Mr. Gacy in 2010, based on the book The Last Victim by Jason Moss, as well as 8213 Gacy House, 2010, paranormal investigators spent a night in the house that is now sitting where the Grizzly Death House once stood. Documentaries on the Discovery Channel, Investigation Discovery Channel, Biography Channel, Lifetime Movie, Monster in My Family, as well as the docu-series John Wayne Gacy, Devil in Disguise on Peacock. There is also a podcast series about it. It's in 8 episodes. It's called The Clown and the Candyman. which went from 2020 to this year. So if you can find it, go check it out. It is narrated by Jacqueline Bynon, as well as one other one that's not listed on the Wikipedia article that I used, the episode you are listening now to now. Alright, that was the full story of the early life, previous sentences, charges, and murders, and the end, the downfall of the killer clown serial killer, John Wayne Gacy. Now, I think there's also been a rumor that he is what partly inspired Pennywise, maybe just because Pennywise is a clown and Gacy also had two clown personas, but that I don't think was ever confirmed. It's just something I heard on the internet. But anyways, I hope you all have a great day, a great life, a great whatever. Stay safe, wear a mask if you're not vaccinated. And I'll see you next time. Bye!